Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Good morning. I'm going to start with a quote. The indefatigable pursuit of an unattainable perfection, even though it consists of nothing more than the pounding of an old piano, is what alone gives a meaning to our life on this unavailing star. That's from Logan Pearsall Smith in 1931. So I have some arguments with this statement, but at the same time, I applaud the encouragement to reach audaciously for high goals, lofty aspirations. When we are inspired, the work to achieve a goal is energized by that inspiration, and our whole life is enlivened by that energy. Our outlook tends to be brightened by that energy. And then, lying in the shadow of that, are a million and one things that get in the way of achieving those goals. If my goal is to write the great American novel and I get writer's block after chapter 3, do I get frustrated? Do I get depressed? Do I get angry? Do I give up? If my goal is to win Salesman of the Year award and I fall short of my quota halfway through the year, do I label myself a loser? These things sneak up on us. We had a conversation about health issues during lunch yesterday. How often do we get the feeling that if we have an issue, it's because of some fault of our own? We don't eat right, we don't exercise enough, we don't exercise the right way, we haven't resolved our psychological issues. So any of these can be causal or contributors to our troubles, of course. But we complicate our relationship to difficulties when we toggle between high hopes and despair, when we toggle between confidence and pessimism. In March 2008, there was an article in Psychology Today titled "The Pitfalls of Perfectionism." I'm going to read a piece of that. Perfectionism may be the ultimate self-defeating behavior. It turns people into slaves of success, but keeps them focused on failure, dooming them to a lifetime of doubt and depression. It also winds up undermining achievement in the modern world. You could say that perfectionism is a crime against humanity. Adaptability is the characteristic that enables the species to survive, and if there's one thing perfectionism does, it rigidifies behavior. It constricts people just when the fast-moving world requires more flexibility and comfort with ambiguity than ever. It turns people into success slaves. Perfectionist experts now know are made, not born, commonly at an early age. They also know that perfectionism is increasing. I got the idea for this talk in listening to NPR. I've been doing a lot of driving across the city. With my dad's death and being executor, I'm crossing the river and going up to the hills multiple times each week. And sometimes traffic keeps me on the road for quite a while, so I get a lot of NPR. And they were talking about how the use of antidepressants has increased over the years until now, as I remember it, they were saying 1 in 3 adults is taking an antidepressant now. And 10, 20 years ago, it was considerably less. And they were putting it down to a dysphoria that arises from a wide gap between expectations and reality. Somehow we get it in our heads that we're all supposed to be superheroes. We're all supposed to be exceptional. And the fact is, we're just normal. So I would expand that to say there's a gap between our ideal and our perceived reality. I found something called the School of Life on HuffPost. And this is a quote from there. Perfectionism is only a problem because we have under-budgeted for difficulty. I like that. Perfectionism is only a problem because we have under-budgeted for difficulty, not because we are aiming high. Perfectionism is the unreasonable and self-defeating ambition of getting something absolutely right, which makes us difficult to be around and punishing to live with. The origins of perfectionism lie in the imagination, in the ease with which we can conjure up a picture of an ideal state of affairs, compared with the monstrous difficulty of bringing such a state into being by ourselves. The sickness of perfectionism gestates in the fertile gap between our noble visions and our mediocre reality. Now, this comes to play in our Zen practice. In our Zen practice, in our vocabulary, we have high hopes and aspirations fed to us in large helpings. We have precepts, we have Brahma Viharas, and the Paramitas, that translates perfections. We have Samadhi, Kensho, and Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi, complete, perfect enlightenment. And we have 2,500 years of ancestors to model dedication, wisdom, compassion, insight, purity, integrity, and eloquence. How can we hope to aspire to all of these things? If you take this practice seriously, it is possible to get discouraged, very discouraged, by the gap between the noble vision and mediocre reality. Some people are afraid to come into this hall at all for fear they won't do it right. People sometimes get indigestion doing orioki for fear of messing up the forms. People get so anxious about sanzen that they forget what they wanted to ask once they get through the door. I understand that. Budgeting for difficulty in this practice might mean returning to beginner's mind over and over again. Beginner's mind is accepting of mediocre reality and pounding on the piano anyway, hoping for 1 or 2 good notes. Beginner's mind accepts, I am not serene, but I'll sit anyway, hoping for 1 or 2 moments of equanimity. Beginner's mind is not calculating how lofty a goal to set or how fast it should be attained. Beginner's mind is willing to try and see. Let's see how it goes. If you identify yourself as a perfectionist, you've been cultivating the drive to perfection for a very long time. If you recognize that it is creating anxiety and other problems for you, it can be reduced. It can be overcome, but not quickly. It takes patience, perseverance, and above all, kindness. And it's the same with any endeavor in our practice of cultivating wisdom and compassion, in our practice of resolving old karma, in our practice of coming into alignment with the precepts. We make progress by being honest with ourselves about who we are in our mediocre reality, and by being gently forgiving when we are unskillful, and by maintaining our respectful desire to become more skillful, step by step, moment by moment. The next retreat on the schedule is Denkoe, which translates transmission, light, celebration. The theme of Denkoe is found in the historical tales of our human ancestors in this lineage. The story of a meeting between a teacher and a student becoming transformed through working with that teacher. The stories that are written down is called the Denko Roku. They are short, poetic condensations of the life of practice and the process of transformation. They are not meant as documentaries, but as inspiration. Each one is different. And that is part of the joy of the Denko Roku, is everyone is different. Just as everyone in this hall is different. Different karma, different strengths, different weaknesses, different koans. Differences in that mediocre reality. And differences in the hopes and aspirations. And year after year, after we go into the stories of one of these ancestors, we get some insight into how those differences can play out and result in insight, wisdom, compassion, enlightenment, a different form of perfection. Your individual differences are not of themselves a barrier to enlightenment. The Dharma talks during the retreat will help to unpack some of the condensation of the stories and help you to understand the teaching behind the story. I would encourage you to take the plunge into this opportunity to inspire your life of practice. And if you do attend the retreat, I would encourage you to bring beginner's mind. Just try it. See where it takes you. Bring your patience. Bring your courage. And bring your kindness. And that's my imperfect talk for the day.
Thank you for that. You know, when I've reflected upon the idea of perfectionism, I get the feeling of this, like, expectation, ideal, and attachment, and all these other kind of really horrific implications. So I was wondering where do you think that sense of perfection has kind of come from in our culture or in our lives, or where might there be some origins of this habitual attachment to expectation and how life is?
You know the story of the arrow?
I don't, actually, if you want to recount it.
A man is lying on the ground. He's got an arrow stuck in him. You don't ask where the arrow came from, what it's made of, who made it, who shot it. You just try to deal with it. Heal the wound.
Thank you.
I'm just thinking about and looking around at the kind of beauty and serenity that it seems like we're sort of holding up and trying to practice, and I guess just in light of what you're talking about in terms of perfectionism, just sort of wondering, does that potentially do more harm than good in some ways? Is there a way that we can uphold humanness more? And I'm not sure, but just kind of curious about all that and this kind of something feels good about us all trying to be good and and kind of keep ourselves in line. And
yeah.
So
when I started studying the precepts, I came at it with a perfectionist attitude and got very rigid about my own behavior, and that rigidity translated to other people too. So I was less than kind in my, I mean, I didn't blurt all the things I was thinking, but I was thinking some not very kind things about people and their behaviors. And it took me quite a while to get off my high horse and relax about my own behavior and the behavior of others, and realize that I can have an aspiration to not kill, not steal, not be abusive. Without being afraid that I'm going to make a mistake, I can live with my mistakes, and that relaxing into it means the mistakes that I make are a lot smaller. When I was really rigid about it, the mistakes I was making inside my own head were enormous. I was cutting people off, which is not what the precepts are encouraging us to do. So I was violating the precepts by being rigid about them. And so, yes, we can celebrate and relax into our humanity and still have aspirations. But I think it's partly not being afraid to be imperfect that gives us the freedom to both have the aspiration and our blessed mediocrity.
Thank you.
Well, as you know, I work with people in prison, and those folks not only have been judged officially by society as having transgressed in some evidently unforgivable way, but then they're continuing in that environment to get sort of pounded with mm-hmm. every mistake that they make. They have mm-hmm. to, like, they get DRs, they get all kinds of stuff. And so part of my challenge in working with them is particularly I found it around, we do term vows for mm-hmm. a couple of months a year. And after about the first time through that, I realized, okay, we got to talk about this, because it can become just another way to bludgeon people about mm-hmm. their imperfections. And so mm-hmm. One of the things I now stress is it is quite possible to keep a vow perfectly by failing it. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, that is often the most fruitful way mm-hmm. to work with a vow. Mm-hmm. So that's budgeting for difficulty. I really like that.
Yeah.
That concept of understanding that probably when we turn our attention to an aspiration, which I believe all of us have these aspirations mm-hmm. internally anyway, mm-hmm. and so all of the things we say are just sort of recognizing and validating that, that we start turning our attention to that, we start seeing all the ways that we fall short mm-hmm. of that. And so the way to work with that is not to just get all pissed off about it and judgmental about it, but just to notice it and just keep noticing, which is mm-hmm. our practice, mm-hmm. and allowing ourselves to mess up, because that's what we do. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I can say all of this with a great deal of heart because I've had to work on this myself mm-hmm. in my life, where getting to the point where I could make mistakes and make them wholeheartedly mm-hmm. with a certain amount of lightheartedness mm-hmm. as well. And that's really how we go on. But it's a very interesting way to work with in a particular situation where they're really up against that in mm-hmm. a way that most of us are not quite. Mm-hmm. So, but it is does seem to be pervasive in the culture. Mm-hmm. So,
thank you.
Morning. So a line that I always liked was that expectations are premeditated resentments. And I find that perfectionism seems to translate better to me when it's about expectations. Mm-hmm. It's my massive amount of expectations that of myself that translates out to others. It's usually when it jumps out to others, it's my self-talk that I'm doing. And I find that that's where almost all the juice of my practice on trying to sit is around, mm-hmm. is around my expectations of the way things should be as opposed to the way they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, It's like the dog that just keeps chasing the tail, but it's burrowing at the same time. It's like it's doing it so fast that it just comes going down. And so I find that that seems to be the massive way that I struggle, because then it shoots out when it goes to others. Then there's the guilt about my expectations and the work that I did that's now affecting them. It's like jumping into a pool and then coming out and shaking out, and everybody around you that's close to you is affected by the water that's coming off you. It's that it keeps going. And so it's this massive kind of, I mean, it's just huge. I mean, like how deep it can go and how the cycle can feed in on itself around this expectation piece of it. And the only thing I've found that has worked is done some work around subpersonality stuff of like actually trying to name it, mm-hmm. you know, to the teacher or whoever it is, you know, that's in your head, you know, the perfectionist, the ruler, whatever, but then also to sit. And I mean, and it just, but it's the only thing that seems to be the medicine for it for me. And it's, mm-hmm. but that massiveness of how it feeds on itself is just huge.
Yeah. And it's important that you not create a new expectation that you're going to be able to fix this and erase it from your life, because it is huge, and because it's taken up a big piece of your mental activity. It just, it's drip by drip by drip by drip by drip. You erode it. And if you just, that's why patience and courage are important. As much of that as you can bring to it, that translates as kindness.
Chefs can be some of the most perfectionist people, and I've had a lot of experience meeting that personality when you fall short, and it can be such a painful, scary experience.
Yeah.
And seeing it arise in yourself is also equally as painful and scary. And on the opposite end of that, when you meet someone who is open to the failures and maybe not even failures, just open, mm-hmm. it is very peaceful. Mm-hmm. And the other day, Shinyu was not here, and we were cooking dinner, mm-hmm. and I was so scared. I was so scared that it wasn't right, mm-hmm. and that I was going to get in so much trouble. Mm-hmm. But it turned out okay, mm-hmm. and I really appreciated that experience.
Good. Good.
So how do you balance your budget for difficulties with right effort? Like, it feels like it can be easy to sort of become lackadaisical and say, well, I'm not perfect anyway, so
sure.
That's it right there.
Sure.
And then complacent.
It's a moving target. You don't just get to dial it to number three and know you're there. Just notice. Just keep noticing. I'm getting lazy.
Okay, thanks.
So I think, like most or all of us, I've spent a fair amount of time with my inner perfectionist, inner critic, and I've noticed that I think one of the reasons why it comes up so much is because that voice that's kind of harsh and mm-hmm. is is actually more effective in getting me to respond. And so that is like, it's one of the tricky things. I think that might be part of what a lot of people are saying here, is that like we're afraid that without that voice that things will just fall apart, that we'll be lazy, that we'll fail to keep our commitments, and so what if that, like, what is it that drives us to, what is it that is effective, that drives us consistently to keep our obligations and responsibilities without that fear of the inner critic or the outer critic? Or
think of carrot and stick, and that harsh voice is the stick. What's the carrot?
Mm-hmm. What is the, are you asking me the what is the carrot?
Well, I think
I don't know.
I think that's what you need to find, because these aspirations really are carrots. They're beautiful views of what is possible, and when we bask in that energy, we are energized. We do move forward. We do make progress because we want to. Not because there's that hag in the back of the head that's chasing us, but because there is a beautiful view and we want to be in harmony with it.
Thank you.
I'm kind of tagging off of what Gabe said, and that, but twisting it a little, to see if you can speak to the importance of being, of some of us who come here, needing to glimpse perfection, not having a relationship with that view at all. And Zen really can offer, I think, that glimpse. And maybe that's what you were saying to Sarah there. You know, it's the aspiration, mm-hmm. that the tone of it and the energy of it. But without the promise of it, what do we have? It is here.
And I don't think people come back through the door a second time unless they've had a hint. They smelled something. They thought they heard something. And that is a glimpse. That is, it's not a promise. But the beginner's mind says, maybe let's try it, see what happens. That's because of a glimpse. That's because of something whispering to the heart that there may be something here. There may be something in this practice. There may be something. Worth following. And when we are in that state of maybe, we are not rigid. We are not perfectionists at that point.
So do you think it can be completely nonverbal sometimes?
Absolutely.
And somehow just present in the room when you come here.
I think I think there are certain traits that are distinctly overvalued, and eloquence is one of them. And charm is one of them. And there are things that we undervalue that are true and beautiful and inexpressible.
Thank you. Yes.
So the concept of not getting hung up on that rigidity, it resonates with me a lot. It's something I've been working on in many aspects of my life, including talking about with my therapist. And I struggle a lot with my internal critic and the concept that my internal critic is my internal motivator, and what would I do without that motivation. But I've been challenging that recently. One of my favorite books right now is a book called Feeling Good. It's a cognitive behavioral therapy book that talks about a lot about the way we should ourselves and how that's not actually a very positive thing. And going back to your point of the carrot and the stick, a really helpful anecdote for me that the author himself talks about as a therapist himself, he was putting himself on a diet and he set up a reward system. So, you know, if he didn't eat ice cream, he could have a donut and some candy at the end of the day. But this reward system, he would reward himself even when he didn't do it because he was trying. And he talks about how it was so pleasurable that he would reward himself for the effort even if he didn't achieve it, that he eventually got to the state where, you know, he reached his goal weight. And that concept was so foreign to me but so delightful that I sort of was like, oh, I guess I could reward myself for trying. You don't have to arrive. And frankly, I've also been contemplating, you know, perfection is this state we never really reach, and if we did, how boring that would be, to at least in the sense of the external perfections we talk about. Like, well, I really enjoy the striving. And so the other principle I try to embrace is the concept of solutions, not blame. And so, well, if I didn't make it this time, you know, how can I try the next time? What can I do? And try and release the thing I did not manage to be perfect at and be grateful that I can try again.
Yeah. I sometimes think that we do ourselves a disservice when we think of ourselves as adults, that if we thought of ourselves more as children and tried to see our struggles as those of a child learning how to walk or talk, is we applaud the effort and we're not dismayed by the falling down. We're not dismayed by the mispronunciation of words. It's just, it's cute. And it's perfect. It is. It's just perfect.
My sense is that it matters where aspiration is arising, where it's arising from. So my question is around right or wise aspiration, mm-hmm. wise intention. Mm-hmm. And I think where it's arising from affects also our relation to perfection around it.
Hmm.
So I wonder if you can elaborate on discerning where it's arising from.
The only thing that comes to mind is trial and error, that if we get too embroiled in judging the source of our inspiration, it's a different kind of perfectionism, but whatever inspires you, you kind of have to go with it until you see that it's either not working or it's working in a way that is not fulfilling. So, you know, if I have the aspiration to write the great American novel, and it's because I want to be famous, at some point that's going to ring hollow for me. It's not a noble aspiration. It's kind of silly and self-centered. But if that's what inspires me, I have to do it. And then when it rings hollow, I can quit. And it might be after my third novel and I'm on the cover of Time, but then I discover that fame isn't all it's cracked up to be. And then maybe I go looking for something deeper. But we don't start at the highest values. We start with whatever really inspires us. And maybe it's just walking.
So, as an example, if somebody's aspiration is to look like a great Buddhist practitioner,
right?
just go with that until
sure,
and learn what you can from the sensory experience of going for that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. She just said, fake it till you make it.
Hi. I want to ask about the value of being imperfect or failing and being seen doing it versus not. Uh-huh. Because as a person who aspires to have a career as a creative person, I often... want to show people the perfect stuff and hide all the imperfect stuff, which mm-hmm. is most of it mm-hmm. by far. And that can be a problem if it looks like I'm not working, for example. Mm-hmm. And it also can be really stifling. But on the other hand, you know, if I do show just the perfect stuff, then I might get a reputation for having high standards or mm-hmm. making good work. Is there value in choosing even, like, to be seen failing, or what can I get from that?
Well, I don't know how you can... monetize your failures. But I think in terms of your own equanimity... it is useful to be open with the fact that you do a lot of work that you're not satisfied with. And letting people see that is like letting people see a 3-year-old stumble. It's okay. And in fact, there's something sweet about the effort. And so, and you never know what somebody else is going to see in the things that don't meet your standard. Sometimes those imperfect things can strike a chord that wasn't your intention, but is significant to the person who's seeing it. And so perfectionism in the sense of art is an artifice. Yeah?
Yeah.
It's all in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.